space associated to gauge systems, and we found that we have constraints, and on the other hand, we have also gauge orbits, and actually the physical phase space is the one you get first by going to the constrained hypersurface and then by actually quotienting out by these gauge orbits. And so there's this remark that for many systems, that's basically impossible to do one-to-one in a way which would be convenient. And basically in Young-Mills, that already holds, and more so in gravity. And so what one has devised, or actually what has become known as Dirac quantization, probably after Dirac, and is a method to quantize gauge systems. And the interesting thing is what actually historically one would think that Young-Mills systems are the first gauge systems. That's actually not true. It's actually that gravity was discovered, kind of classified first as a gauge system. And Dirac was thinking about quantum gravity. And was one also coming up with a constraint algebra of Hamiltonian constraints and so on, and that's known as Dirac algebra. And so this procedure is named after him. And the general idea is that you actually start with quantizing the so-called kinematical phase space, and that leads to a kinematical Hilbert space of states. And then you need to do something with the constraints you have in your systems. And the constraints do two things. They have to be satisfied classically, but they also generate gauge orbits by which you are supposed to factor out. And in the quantum theory, that will be. Both these tasks will be accomplished by something which is called imposing the constraints. And so we basically will describe this procedure where, and actually also for gravity, that what one usually does, one first goes to the kinematical Hilbert space, then one is very happy, and then one says, basically, now we need to impose the constraints, and that's, of course, a difficult task. Not in 2 plus 1, but in 3 plus 1. Okay, and so let's actually look again and not start with gravity right away, but look at the almost simplest example for a gauge system. But this will basically tell you also all what you need to know about this constraint quantization, or lots of things, and also tell you that's not such a mystery. Okay, so that's a parameterized particle. And so that's actually just classical mechanics, and which you are very used to. So you can do that actually with any system. And you can also do that with field theory, which is actually what Dirac originally did. He took free field theory and then decided that he wanted to add the coordinates as variables. And that's what one could always do. So we actually take some Lagrangian, and sometimes this is also considered if the Lagrangian is time independent. And so we take this Lagrangian and we decide to add t, to add our time variable as an independent variable. So basically, it should have at some point the same status as q, which would be the position of our particle. So if you add t as an independent variable, and that was so that's supposed to be the time variable. You need another parameter. Which is auxiliary. And let's say it's just an auxiliary evolution parameter. Which will be called S. And so you want to actually change now this action. So this action used to be a functional of path, which were q of t. And so they had some fixed starting and endpoint and so on. So information which are usually is very nicely hidden there and I never write. And so what we want to do is to introduce another action. And so now we introduce this other parameter. So we would need to consider now another evolution parameter and we consider actually now at least a two-dimensional path. You could actually allow any number of variables here, but it doesn't make it more complicated or more insightful. So you introduce this. You want to introduce such an action with this kind of path, where now also t is one variable. So here you consider q. This graph QSTS. And then you, however, want that this action gives you the same kind of stationary solutions than this action varying both Q and T. And that in particular would mean that you want to have that if you find a solution Q of T here, a minimum, you achieve that if you give basically all trajectories QS and TS, which lead to the same Q of T, the same action as here. So basically, the kind of just the numerical value of the action, you want it to be the same. Here, of course, you have much more trajectories. I mean, you already see the subject which will be coming up than here, because different functions T of S here. Together with different functions Q of S can nevertheless lead to the same relations Q of T. Okay, so how to do that? So basically we need to replace everything here by things which would now be relate to S using as a time evolution. So here we would have the same thing, the Lagrangian. However, Q dot is obviously here my language, it would be dq dt. And so instead of dq dt, we should use Q prime. And so actually, one should apply here something like the chain rule, the other way around. To get Q dot. So prime and denotes differentiation with respect to S, a dot with respect to T. And then the other thing which we need to consider is that here we integrate with respect to dt. And so, of course, we want to integrate over ds, but in fact, to get the correct value, we would again put here dt ds, which is t prime. So that's the same as having a determinant of the matrix. Okay, so that's our action. Oops. And basically, you can check the equation of motion. But let's just do canonical analysis of this action. SP. And so we would first have a momentum which is conjugated to time. And so this would be defined as the derivative of this action with respect to t prime. And so let's take the derivative. So we have here something an L. Let me not write this. So we have one term L, then we have another term which comes multiplied with t prime. We have t prime appearing in the second argument, and the second argument used to be q dot. So it's dl dq dot. And then we need to take the derivative of this thing, of this argument, and that is minus q prime divided by t prime squared. And if you remember, actually, dl dq prime would have been basically, as we will see, it is still pq minus h, where h is a Hamiltonian. Oh, sorry. This is pq plus l. Let's define that, but let's define what this p is. And so we take here the derivative of this action with respect to q prime. And so we have a t prime in front, and then we have again dl dq prime. 1 over t prime. So this is just dl dq dot. So in fact, this is my pq. It's dl dq dot. And you might recognize this as a definition of minus a Hamiltonian. In the unparametrized system. And so what do you see? So usually the momenta come in a form where it says momentum on the left hand side is something where on the right hand side you have a time derivative. And in fact, you can count on having a time derivative here, because you take the derivative of this Lagrangian. So in case you have a standard kinematical system, there will be something like a Q prime here, and maybe multiply it with a T prime. And so you could have hoped that T prime will show up here, but in fact it doesn't. Here you basically have, again, to write it, you know, more concretely, you have an equation which only involves phase space variables. There's no time derivatives. And so this is actually a constraint. And so actually you would have to write it in this form that the constraint which has to hold is that PT plus this standard Hamiltonian, the little h is zero. And in fact, it's completely consistent that you introduce the momentum which is supposed to take to give you the time derivative minus one. And PT is supposed to do time evolution. And so in fact, having a constraint, putting these things together gives you then the same kind of time evolution for the other variable Q and PQ. OK, so we found, not very surprisingly, a constraint system. And you could define Hamiltonian of the system. And you can do that again by now by the Legendre transformation. So that would be the Legendre transformation. And you find that is Q dot is surprise, surprise, you find that this is given by T prime PT, and then you have this term PQ Q dot minus L. And let's hope we get here the right sign. So we get a multiple of the constraint. And the multiple, or in this case, again, the Lagrange multiplier, is given by T prime. And so in fact, T prime can be understood as kind of the velocity of T with respect to S. And that's what one can completely choose completely freely, even freely in a time-dependent way, because that just gives you a reparametrization of this curve in S, which doesn't change physics, because the thing which we are actually looking at are just trajectories here in QT. So basically, we have a totally constrained system. Where this Hamiltonian is a combination of constraints, is a simple combination, and in fact, you know, one can figure out what does this Hamiltonian generate. And so T prime, if you take T prime to be just some Lagrange multiplier with this constraint, then C is something linear in PT, so that will give you N. And that would give you Q with little h, which is just the usual time derivative defined to be Q dot. And so you see that N is indeed the conversion factor between Q prime and Q dot. And so this has to be understood as gauge transformation, because N can be any arbitrary number. And it has something to do that we are actually unable to solve for T prime. So that happens actually usually in constrained systems, that one is unable to solve for some of the velocities. And in this case, it's T prime. in the other cases, it used to be the velocities of what turned out to be Lagrange multipliers. Okay. So we have a gauge transformation. It's quite puzzling. You could say time evolution is a gauge transformation. but in fact, we can basically regain our original interpretation by applying some common sense. So in the last lecture, I told you about Dirac observables and gauge fixings and so on. And so the question is, can we basically formulate our system in these gauge invariant terms so that we regain our standard interpretation? And so one version how to regain the usual interpretation or the reduced phase space was to apply a gauge fixing. And in these totally constrained system, a gauge fixing will give you just one moment of time evolution, if time evolution itself is a gauge transformation. So in these cases, you could decide to choose a family of gauge fixings which regains you time evolution. So what kind of family would you choose? So you define a little, could define a phase-based function which is tau dependent, and you choose something like t minus tau. And so your gauge fixed observer will be basically give you the phase-based function or the value of q at the time where t is equal to tau. And so, in fact, what you have to do in this case is that you have to solve the system, because given a trajectory, basically you have lots of trajectories in principle, and they look usually a bit more regular, but maybe not. You ask the following question: given a pair q tau, qt, and actually also pt, pq, so given initial data, and they should satisfy the constraint. Now, since the constraint is so simple, it just solved if you set pt equal to the rest of pt equal to this little h. So given these data, so you are here somewhere, and then you asked with this question, what is actually the value of q at the point where my t is equal to tau? So actually, you need to figure out what is the trajectory through this phase-based point, and then you need to figure out where to find this point where t is equal to tau, and to find your value of q. So basically, this would be your answer, which is this q. Now, there are many q's floating around. So you want to have this function, this as a function of these initial values. And so in fact, if you have a free particle, I mean, in general, you need to solve the system, as I told you. But maybe we can reconstruct the solution for the free particle modulus signs and factors of 1/2 and n, depending on your definition of h. So I guess so in fact, this gives you what is called a relational observer between this variable t, which you use as a clock, understandably, and the variable q, which is the thing which you observe in this case. You can compute that, in fact, for all taus, this is indeed a Dirac observable. So this commutes even strongly, and you can also figure that out. If you would figure out the solution, you can write in an abstract term that this gives you a Dirac observable. Except that it doesn't. So, in fact, if tau is bigger than the t you are at, you still need to go a certain amount given by this momentum pq to be at to reach tau. So it's a plus sign. And so you can do a fast check that this, in fact, gives you zero. And this gives you a priori lots of Dirac observables because you get one for every tau. but you see that basically gives you only two independent ones, namely q. If you set tau to zero, it gives you q minus t pq divided by m. And pq itself, which in fact, since it's constant for a free particle, pq is a, in fact, would be the observable of related to pq. And it tells you what is pq if pq is equal to tau, if t is equal to tau, and it's constant, so you just get a constant. And these are the only two independent Dirac observables. In fact, if you apply it to the other coordinates, if you asked what is t, if t is equal to tau, the answer is tau. That is not such an interesting question to ask, so that's not an independent observable. If you ask what is pt, if is t equal to tau, no, pt will be also constant, but pt is equal to the little h, the Hamiltonian, and this little Hamiltonian in this case is just a function of pq and q. So we already covered this case. So there are only two independent Dirac observables, and moreover, in fact, these are canonically conjugated. So you need actually to put the same tau. It meets equal time commutation relations. And these are equal to one. Now in this case, it's also easy to discuss time relations and commutation relations. If these taus are not equal, then again, you need to compute and you get something which depends on the dynamics. And basically, that would be something like the Green's function or the two-point function in the quantum theory. Actually, yeah. So this should remind you, of course, to the fact that Q and P are canonically conjugated, and this was our original phase space. And so, in fact, in technical terms, there is actually a symplectomorphism between the reduced phase space and the original phase space. And so it just means that we have found the same physics starting from these two different formulations. So as an exercise at home, you can do the same exercise choosing another time observable, Q, and you will already encounter lots of problems one encounters in general relativity in figuring out what these things are and what this relation could be. And it gives you an easy example to see difficulties which come up if you don't have a perfect clock variable. Especially so in quantization, which is an even more interesting exercise. So let's go to quantization. So in fact, this idea, you can take this idea of having, if you have a gauge system, then basically something like this always happens. And that's a gauge system is something like a parameterized system. And then you can try to deparameterize the system. But for that, you need to identify good clocks, and that's usually the problem. But locally, your system is kind of always of this form, except it's higher dimensional. You might have more constraints. But again, even locally, you can kind of abelianize the constraints. So it's always this kind of action or situation that you have. And so you have basically something which you could identify as a gauge direction, T and PT, and which you need to mod out. And the difficulty is that in quantization, usually, it's a very non-local process. So in this case, it's again straightforward to do quantization, and this Dirac quantization. But in general, it's a bit simpler. It's a bit harder. So basically, we started with this phase space. And we wanted to have more variables. So actually, we have now this four-dimensional kinematical phase space. And so we would apply the usual kind of Schrödinger-like quantization, which would mean, now Schrödinger is used in too many terms, but which would, in this case, would mean we take a configuration space of square integrable functions over R2, some particular the measure we would just take as dq dt. So consider wave functions phi qt where you would integrate over both dq and dt. And that would define your kinematical Hilbert space. So the state, the space of kinematical states. And so quantization means putting heads over our variables. Definitely. It means to find a representation of our phase space observable algebra so that the phase the symplectic stuff, so that the Poisson brackets reproduce a commutator kind of as much as possible. But in fact, as we will discuss later, you should cleverly choose your set of observables which you want to represent. And in this case, it's easy. We just take QT, PQ, and PT and have to find a representation on the space. And so this is basically the usual thing which we do is that these things act as multiplication operators. And PQ acts as derivative operators with some i's and so on, which I usually forget, minus I h bar. Okay, so that gives us a representation of our basic observables on the Silver space, and you can check that the commutator reproduces the Poisson brackets modulo this h bar and I terms. So this is front, okay. Because this is our kinematical Hilbert space, and in principle it's nice because now we found actually sometimes something which one doesn't usually have, and this is time as an operator and also PT as an operator. However, classically we know that only these things which satisfy the constraint, only states which satisfy the constraints are physically interesting. So in fact, one would ask for states which also satisfy the constraints and would replace the classical constraints by a suitable quantization of these classical constraints, where of course usually there's lots of questions about quantum operator ordering. And the other thing is that we said, like observables F in this context should commute or commute weakly with the constraints. And that means that observables should be invariant under the flow generated by the constraints, which I abbreviate as constraint flow. And so in fact, this equation automatically ensures that the wave function is invariant under gauge transformations generated by the constraints. As we will see, but if you don't believe me, just take this example that you, for instance, take C equal to the momentum PQ. So this is an example. C is equal to, so then C obviously generates translations in Q. And so what would satisfy this equation? Okay. Wave function satisfies this equation. Yeah, so it has to be constant in Q. And so in fact means that the wave function is invariant under translations, and these translations are exactly the gauge transformations, which are generated by this constraint. So in fact, this is also a gauge invariance condition. And so what we ensure is that we throw out actually automatically with this equation basically states which don't satisfy the constraints, but it also means that we ignore quantum fluctuations in the gauge directions. So it's basically, and that's quantum mechanics for you. So it just means that you peak completely the state in one direction. So basically, constrained systems, you know, it's never Gaussian, but you peak the state in one direction, but it's completely spread out in the conjugated direction. And the conjugated direction is exactly the one which is the gauge direction. So you make it constant on the gauge orbit. And by uncertainty relation, that goes basically infinite peakness in one direction goes with infinite spread in the other, in the conjugated direction, and the other way around. Okay. So let's look at the equation. So that's what we have to impose. So let's write that out. So we want that this is zero, and we have PT. And then there was a plus sign, plus H. So we have to find a quantization of our Hamiltonian applied to psi. And this has to be zero. That's a constraint equation.
As a name?
Ah. So there's a Schrödinger equation, which is on his grave. Apparently, that's the biggest accomplishment you can get. and so you see in this context, for totally constrained systems, that's actually always true. Constraint equation is equal to the equation of motion. We said that several times. And so it's a quantum equation of motion. and that makes in general, you know, gravity or handling these things so difficult. When in these simple systems, I mean, if H is simple, it's a simple system, we can solve it explicitly and do everything. In more complicated systems, it means we need to find all solutions to the Schrödinger equation. So I assume we can solve all Schrödinger problems. I mean, all these kind of, which is already a bit hard, but let's assume that. But there's one last step which we need to discuss. And that's assume you found a solution and actually not just one solution, but all solutions to the system. And of course, we know how to solve it. What is the solution to the thing? So that's actually all solutions you can get. and of course, you can start with different times, but then there will be non-trivial overlaps between the things you generate. And so you get a different solution for different choices of here of your initial data. And then you say, okay, nice. I have my physical solutions. I have a Hilbert space. So what I need is also kind of an inner product for these physical solutions. So let's take this thing which we had. Take one thing. Take another physical solution. And we put it into our inner product. And so what will happen? Yeah, in fact, as you might remember, there was something peculiar about usual time evolution. It used to be unitary in the usual inner product, and the usual inner product was just given by integration over Q. So that wouldn't cancel in this simple way, but it cancels in this, at least in this kind of integral. This is by unitary of time evolution equal to the inner product between our initial values. And so it's constant in time, and then we take the derivative from minus infinity to plus infinity of something which is constant, which of course gives us infinity. And one shouldn't have been surprised. Because in all these, I mean, this example of constraints where you have one thing which is linear, PT, it generates kind of non-compact gauge orbits. It's similar to PQ. and we found that you would find wave functions which are constant in Q. And of course, they cannot be integrated over Q, which would be the kinematical Hilbert space integral. And so here we find the same result, that we integrate wave functions which are constant along the gauge orbits. The gauge orbits have infinite volume, actually infinite length in this case. And so we find infinity. And this always happens because, I mean, that doesn't always happen. It always happens if the gauge orbits are non-compact, which sometimes correlates with the fact that the spectrum of the constraint is continuous around zero, or there's not even a spectrum, which makes things not simpler. And of course, in this case, we know the answer, because we know here we get something constant in time. So if you would just drop the T equation, then we can define basically the inner product for a physical solution for any T. And again, unitarity of time evolution would ensure that we get the same result for any t. so again, in these easy cases where you have well-defined gauge orbits, which are linear and so on, this is the way to go. In general, this is a kind of open problem, or depending on on the system, less or more open. So one needs a physical inner product. And there are many different procedures to define a physical inner product. In the end, one can do it actually by path integral methods, at least on a heuristic level. And there's more to say about this interpretation of this case. And for instance, in fact, one can ask what happens if I take basically here a physical solution which was produced with different initial values, and I can do things here like actually superpose solutions starting from different initial values. And you could argue that's actually nicer to do because this strict initial value problem is kind of unnatural. And these things, this physical inner product, if you drop T, is usually interpreted as transition amplitudes, but actually one needs to be careful with this interpretation of really transition amplitudes. So one can work out this interpretation. but here basically you need physical inner product on space of solutions. We will see also in 3D gravity that we need to construct a physical inner product on the space of solutions, because solutions will have infinite norm in the kinematic Hilbert space, space of solutions. So one can go on and quantize Dirac observables on the space of solutions. Let me just say that this condition, let me write it here, of being a of being a Dirac observable we had that it should commute with the constraints. At least weakly, let's assume it's strongly. It simplifies the discussion. Now assume that you manage to convert everything into commutators, and then you see why this was a useful condition to have also in quantum theory. So if this is zero, then it means, and this is a solution, then this term vanishes. But then it means that this is also zero. And so you get something which you should maybe remember from dealing with symmetries. If you have a solution and a Dirac observable, you can get a new solution by applying the Dirac observable to the solution. But it actually also means that the observable itself, it gives you a chance to actually be able to quantize it on the physical Hilbert space, assuming you know everything is very nice and this doesn't interfere with possibly different inner products and so on. because it doesn't leave the physical Hilbert space. If this would not be zero, you would have extra terms and would have to care about these terms. So you see that the condition for Poisson commuting exactly gives you a chance to be able to quantize Dirac observables on the physical Hilbert space. And two last words about the constrained algebra. If you have the constrained algebra with structure constant, then again, this should be preferably transferred into the commutator. And again, this allows you actually to find, hopefully a sufficiently large set of solutions to this equation. Because if you would here have a constant term, you would actually not be able to satisfy this equation due to the uncertainty relation. So now you see why this case, if the structure constants are phase space dependent, you have to worry a lot about factor ordering on the right hand side. And having a symmetric ordering on the right hand side, you would get here a term which would be plus CF. And there's no reason that CF applied to the constraints should give zero, or it would give you an additional condition. So in fact, you get kind of in trouble with if you want to have self-adjoint constraints and factor and a correct kind of nice factor ordering for this case. Okay, that's so much about all the theory. And in fact, tomorrow we will go on to quantized geometry. Okay, thank you.